Today is Juneteenth, a holiday marking the day in 1865 that enslaved people in Texas learned they were free. The news did not arrive there for 2.5 years after the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. It is a day to celebrate. At the same time, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has ordered flags to fly at half-staff through tomorrow. She said in a statement, quote, "Juneteenth is a celebration of human dignity and freedom, but it's also a reminder of the dark and irrevocable original sin of this nation, the structural and social effects of which we are sadly still grappling with today," end quote. Voice of the Public welcomes Dr. Bobby Green, president of the NAACP of Doñana County, Ambassador Delano Lewis, and champion boxer Austin Trout. Call with your questions at 575-646-2212, and we'll begin right after NPR News on KRWG Public Media. Good afternoon, and welcome to Voice of the Public. This is KC Counts for KRWG Public Media, and today is Juneteenth. It's a day of celebration, but also day, according to New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, a day that serves as a reminder of the dark and irrevocable original sin of this nation, the structural and social effects of which we are sadly still grappling with today. There will be an event on the NMSU campus this evening for Juneteenth, and I would like to welcome now three wonderful guests to the program. We begin with the president of the NAACP chapter of Doñana County, Dr. Bobby Green. Welcome to KRWG.
Hello, Casey. How are you?
I'm doing well. And Dr. Green and our other guests today are joining us via Zoom. This is a first for some of us, especially, well, I guess maybe just for me, as far as having a live radio show via Zoom. So we've all got our fingers crossed, hoping for the best. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, welcome to the world of Zoom. I've been Zooming quite a bit lately.
We also have Ambassador Delano Lewis, who also served once as president of NPR. Welcome to KRWG, Ambassador Lewis.
Thank you very much, Casey. It's great to be here.
And we have superstar champion boxer Austin Trout joining us today as well. Hi, Austin.
What's up, Casey? Thank you so much for having me.
So good to see you all. And for those of you who are following along on Facebook, obviously you can stream us and watch our show live today. Feel free to follow along on Facebook and chime in with your comments or questions. 646-2212 is the telephone number if you have questions for one or all of our guests. And I want to start with each one of you adding your perspective to it. Has been said that no one knew what Juneteenth was. And obviously, we know that's not true. But for those who maybe weren't so familiar with it, it's been a little bit more of a regional holiday. Delano, let's start with you. Why don't you give us the historical significance of this day?
Yes, this is a very, very important day in the Black community. And I think it should be an important day for all communities. It was the Emancipation Proclamation was issued by President Abraham Lincoln on January 1st, 1863. But it did not get to the Confederate state of Texas until June 19th, 1865, almost 2.5 years later. So the news did not get there. The news came when General Gordon Granger landed on Galveston Island, Texas on June 18th, 1865. And on June 19th, he issued the General Orders Number 3, which Abraham Lincoln had told him to issue, which was freeing the slaves of the Confederacy. So on that date, June 19th, 1865, when the slaves of the Confederacy were freed, and that became Juneteenth Day. And
Bobby,
some call it Freedom Day, some call it Celebration Day.
Thank you, Delano. Bobby, I'd like to ask you, what must that have looked like? What must it have sounded like? What do you think it would have been like to get that news?
Well, I traced my ancestry recently and I saw literally the route that the slave ship took and landed on Virginia and then went from Virginia to Tennessee, from Tennessee to Oklahoma, Oklahoma to Texas. And that's where my family, what my parents were both born in Texas. And so the realization that they were slaves when they got here and that they have fought ever since for, you know, they went through the slavery, then they went through Jim Crow, and you know, now we're going through what we're dealing with right now. So my ancestors were some of the ones that survived. A lot of the slaves did not survive. Hundreds of thousands of slaves did not survive that trip. And so only it's the survival of the fittest kind of thing. And when I was a kid, I remember we'd go to Apodaca Park. We'd have the barbecue, best barbecue ever. And I didn't really understand. All I knew is we got some barbecue. We got some strawberry soda. We call it red soda. And we got some pound cake. But when I grew up and got to know, because of course you didn't get it from the textbook. But when I came to know what the significance of it was, I thought it was critical that we recognize it. I would love to see the curriculums updated to reflect that history, because I think we do a terrible disservice to our kids to not let them know what the history really is.
Austin, did you grow up with Juneteenth as a holiday that your family celebrated?
Well, yes and no. Being from Las Cruces and around the Black community, I remember going to Apodaca Park, going, like she said, getting the barbecue, and, you know, just, you know, congregating with friends and family. But also my mother's from New York, and that does play a big part as far as this Juneteenth, because like you said, it's a regional thing. And the New Yorkers, the African community New Yorkers, look at it more so like it took 2 years for them to figure out that they were free. They didn't really have nothing to do with them. So from that standpoint, my mother, she was like, yeah, no, it's a good day. But, you know, we were free before that. You know, they just didn't know. But what I think is really being ignored is the fact that it took 2 years because of all the different levels of oppression that the Southern slaves were going through, and not the ones that were involved in the war, because they knew what was going on. The war was right there in the back door. But Texas, where, you know, the war wasn't really touched, and, you know, the Wild West, the government didn't really come over here and deal with us or this side of the country as much. It took that long because they didn't know, they weren't taught how to read. The slave owners ain't about to sit there and say, oh, okay, guys, I guess we lost, you're free. They definitely kept that a secret, maliciously, intently, to keep as much slaves as they could. So that's really the underlying real history of it that I failed to really recognize, but until I got older. And so I think we should talk about it, but in a sense to understand, like, look, man, it's systematic. It's the system. It's not even really about them getting the word. It's because the word was held from them.
That,
2 years.
That was literally my next question was because about 50 or 60 years earlier, the Lewis and Clark expedition covered 8,000 miles in 2.5 years. So there clearly was no good reason for people in Texas not to know that they were free and to not be free. Today, this holiday seems to be carrying a greater significance. And I want to go back to Ambassador Lewis to talk about how this year might be different than other years.
Yes, I think it's really already quite different than other years. There is an awakening in this country now that Blacks had known for a long time about racial discrimination and oppression and inequality. But the George Floyd murder, the video is so real and so stark that there's no way to deny it, to put it under the rug, that there are issues in this country, particularly with police and police brutality, and the way they may be feeling about not only George Floyd, but many other Blacks in this country, men and women. So there's something here underneath. And what that underneath is, what's under the surface, is what Dr. Green talked about and Austin just talked about, is this whole issue of slavery. which this country has never faced. It has ignored it, swept it under the rug. It's not talked about. It's not taught about. Or even if it's taught in schools, it's not taught, I think, realistically or truthfully. But there is an awakening, and you hear it now with the athletes coming out and talking about it. You hear it with the Confederate flag being banned from NASCAR racing. You hear about it in terms of the statues commemorating the Confederacy being removed. And my view is you don't need to destroy them. Just put them in a museum because that's history. But you don't need to have them out there because that was a symbol of oppression. So I think things are changing. And just one last point. There was an African-American woman just yesterday who was very high up in State Department. She had worked in the White House. She had worked for Senator McConnell. And she's Assistant Secretary. She was Assistant Secretary for Legislative Affairs, African-American woman, Mary Elizabeth Taylor. And she says, I'm resigning. I cannot deal with the institutional racism coming out of the White House and the way they're approaching these issues. So things are changing, and I think for the best.
There are so many areas, and I do want to touch on as many of them as possible. But Bobby, Delano mentioned the removal of some of these statues and symbols of slavery and tributes to the Confederacy. What about on a more maybe everyday level to all of us, products like Aunt Jemima's syrup and Uncle Ben's rice? Those have been in the news a lot recently, and these companies are finally starting to take, I won't call it a second look, because they've no doubt had to be taking looks at this over the years, time and time again. Is it a significant move for them to change their products?
I think it's critical, and part of it is that there are some implicit biases built in inherently to this systems, and if those implicit biases are not addressed, then they become issues of policing and healthcare and education and all of those things that we're dealing with right now. A primary cause is the implicit biases. And so maybe you cannot change a person's attitudes, but you can legislate how those attitudes are dealt with. And that's what I think we're trying to do right now. I know the NAACP is definitely trying to do that, and they are responsible. They filed a lawsuit for the Dreamers, on behalf of the Dreamers, that was just won yesterday by the Supreme Court. That was an NAACP lawsuit. And so dealing with implicit biases and making legislative changes, you can't change people's attitudes, but you can definitely change the laws.
You mentioned changing people's attitudes. I think that's something that so many of us are struggling with, because we want to change people's attitudes. We want people to be empathetic and to think from Black America's point of view. Austin, I want to ask you, when you're telling someone why these things are hurtful, why they are racist, what do you say?
Well, first and foremost, the thing is, most people are ignorant, you know, and if they do have a chance to actually learn, if they have an open mind to learn, I'm willing to teach. But then also, there's most people that are willingly ignorant and they don't want to hear that. And I don't sit there and want to waste my breath trying to educate somebody that doesn't want to be educated. So that's one of the things to discern. And at the same time, as it's 2020, I'm starting to get tired of having to educate anyone, period. I understand it's not the people's fault. Public schools, for God's sakes, just had I think in Texas, the history book said that the slaves were migrant workers, right? So that's a textbook in 2018 or 19 is what they sat there and called the slaves, as if we had that choice, you know. So the education part, I usually just try to say, like, no, there's a reason why this is all very racist. For example, I have my wife's cousin put up a post that said something like, no lives matter till all lives matter. And she was catching flack, and she couldn't understand why. She's like, no, you know, I'm not racist. I'm like, I understand, but you're just ignorant. Let me put you on game. All lives matter was only made as a response to the fact that Black lives matter. These all lives matter people never cared about all lives, because at the same time, there was locking up children in these concentration camps, you know, for ICE. Whereas, you know, trail of tears. They're not sitting there saying like red lives matter, brown lives matter, or even white lives matter. They just want to say all lives matter to debunk the fact that black lives matter, or to debunk the fact that black lives don't matter to modern America. And we're trying to make them at least look at us like, hey, well, you are a life. Let's not just murder you for nothing. But the thing is, our lives never really mattered. The Constitution originally looked at us as 3/5 of a man. We always just worked. It was always just a way of means to get free labor. I was just watching a doggone video about the Harlem Hellcats, how they sent all these black people to war. But they just wanted to send them out to get murdered or be the guinea pigs or whatever it was. And when these men survived and came back, they was just massacred. That's where Moral Day comes from.
I want to ask you, Austin, what it was like. What did your parents teach you about growing up black in America?
See, that's the thing. My mother, she always put me on game. Like, look, they don't look at you as they look at themselves. For some reason, you always be less in their eyes. There, you know, you have to do double just to get caught up type deal. You know, she's always instilled that in me. She always let me know, though, that, you know, they're wrong for that thought process, and it's wrong that it is this way. But, you know, I always had to have the talks, even as a child, you know, about how to deal with police, and you make sure you mind your manners. Don't you make your hands move too fast, things like that, you know, as a kid. You know, you shouldn't have to tell these things to a child.
Bobby, was your experience similar to that?
Well, I grew up on a farm 5 miles north of Las Cruces, and my family moved from Texas to New Mexico specifically to get us out of an environment that was racially tinged. And I'm grateful for their wisdom. But as a result of their wisdom, I wasn't exposed to the racism. I was the first black child to enroll in MacArthur Elementary School. And my mother told me later that she held her breath when, you know, she'd go and meet with the teachers and what have you. And I never gave it a second thought because I didn't have to think about it. My parents made sure that I would just be a child. I didn't have to be a black child. I didn't have to be an other. I was just a child. And then we really didn't have any neighbors. So we were happy to see anybody when they came because there wasn't anybody around in where I lived. You know, we didn't live around people. So we had family life, we had school, we had church, and I had a great childhood as a result of the wisdom of my parents.
And Delano?
Yes, mine was quite different. I grew up in Kansas City, Kansas, in a segregated community, all black community. So when you ask the question of what did your parents teach you about being black, you lived it. They didn't have to teach you. I grew up in the 50s where there was segregation, segregated lunch counters, segregated facilities, segregated schools. I went to the only black high school in the state of Kansas. I graduated in 56 with one white student in my class. But my parents taught me to be respectful of others, not to hate, to understand that there were issues and problems, but there were ways in which to solve it, and we had to do that peacefully. I want to go back to Austin's point about the education piece, which is so real, and that we were 3/5 of a person. What's happened is once we have just sort of put slavery underneath the cover and not talked about it, one of the things that happens is that you don't understand that we weren't considered human. We were property to be bought, sold, and traded, had no feelings. And in the case of the Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Dr. Kenneth Clark, his testimony as a psychologist was put into the record, where he did an experiment about black and white and about the black dolls and the white dolls, and the white dolls were always superior and the black dolls were inferior. That's the kind of innate things that come with slavery. And that has to be changed, and not only from the oppressor, but also from those who are oppressed in terms of their psyche. And we have to work through that. And one last thing, South Africa understood it. They developed a Truth and Reconciliation Commission where you can come and talk about it and ask for forgiveness.
Bobby, as we move through time, what have been the lasting effects of slavery that we're still grappling with today?
Well, I think part of the problem is that we have been playing catch up It's been 401 years, and it is just unthinkable that in 2020, we are still fighting the same vitriol that we fought back in the 40s and 50s, and that they're, you know, the whole Make America Great Again thing is just a dog whistle. And, you know, now the dog whistle is becoming a bullhorn or an explosion, and it's very loud. And every Black person knows what that means, what Make America Great Again means. You know, they want to go back to the past, but we cannot go back to the past. And it shouldn't be that difficult. All people have to do is just consider that everybody is in the human race. Doesn't have to be Black race, white race, this race, just the human race. It's very simple. The vitriol along racial lines is unsustainable. It is costly. It is traumatic for Black people, certainly. And it cannot... and I think we're at a point where it will not be allowed to continue.
Austin, give us a picture of, you know, how you feel the nation looks today, the importance of the Black Lives Matter movement, the protests that are going on. How would you describe what's happening right now in our country?
I feel like it's something special, I'd say, you know, compared to the recent protests. And I don't mean as far as historically, because you know, I was looking up the research about the Black Panthers and the things they did in the 60s. And oh, God, do we need that now? The organization, the education of the law, the education of our true history, the education of the ways and how to move through this system that wasn't built for us. But if we learned that system, we can make it work for us. I feel like the only issue that my people have is just a lack of education. And today is more prominent than ever because we're just cool. We're just okay, you know. As long as, well, it's not bothering me, so, or it's not over here. So I'm just trying to say that, like, 2020, it doesn't look very different from the 60s. We had 6 hangings within the last week.
Something we want
to try to deem a suicide.
Right. That was something that here in the last few days, we have to start asking ourselves if that's what we're seeing again in this country. Austin, you seem pretty convinced that's what it is.
That's what I'm seeing. And I feel like it's a desperation move. I think that the supremacists feel like their time is almost up, because not just the awakening of my people, but it's your people, too. I've been protesting with so many faces that don't look like mine, but are screaming Black Lives Matter, you know, harder, with more intent, with more passion than I even was. So I think that these are desperation tactics, because they feel like the time is up. Revolution is about to start.
I feel remiss. I have neglected to give the phone number very much, because I'm just so interested to hear as much from you all as we can today. But 646-2212 is the number that you can call if you have a question for Delano, Bobby, or Austin, or all of the above. And I want to get back to your participation in the protests in just a minute and some of the forces that we're seeing at work there. But Delano, would you agree? Are you feeling like these now, I believe, 6 Black men who have been found hanging from trees, do you think those were lynchings?
Go ahead. Do I think what?
Do you think those were lynchings?
Well, I'm not sure, but it certainly appears that way. And there's some things that we really have to face that you've heard from Dr. Green and from Austin, that we have got to face these things. And there's a way to do it. There's a way to do it within the system. What's really exciting is to see as Austin mentioned, those protesters are of all colors and they're all ages. And so there is some awakening here that's happening. And I think we're still seeing some bad things out there, but I think it's beginning to shift, and that shift is happening. I want to mention one other thing about the awakening. When Colin Kaepernick, the football quarterback, took the knee, and the knee is, if you in sports, you know, the knee is sort of like a surrender. I'm not moving forward. But he said the knee is for you to listen and reflect, because there is racial discrimination, There's police brutality. That's why I'm taking the knee. But it was our president who shifted that narrative. He shifted that narrative to he's protesting the flag, and he's protesting, he's not a patriot, so he's anti this country. That's not exactly what happened. And so we didn't hear from anybody with COVID. We saw a few people who would kneel. We saw a few people who supported him. He didn't get a job because the narrative had been shifted. But what's happened today after George Floyd's murder and people are out protesting and people are listening to one another? And when Drew Brees came out, the quarterback from New Orleans, and said, oh, this is all about the flag. Well, he got some pushback. And then he apologized because his mind was open. It was not about the flag. It was about this country. And that narrative was shifted for political reasons. We've got to get back to the truth. And the truth is, we're all in this together.
I think it's amazing to have someone with your perspective who did grow up in segregated America. You mentioned the way you grew up, and because it was segregated, black life was what you knew. But what about when you brought your four sons up?
Well, what's interesting, Bobby mentioned growing up on a farm and growing up not knowing about certain kinds of bigotry and discrimination. Well, just a few miles up the road, my wife grew up in Topeka, Kansas. She grew up in a Catholic community. She grew up in integrated schools. Her parents were educated. She had a very different upbringing than I did, and I was only 60 miles away. So when you ask me about our children, our four sons, you should talk to them, because at dinner table, they got it from both sides. They understood from their mother what her life was like growing up, much different from their father, who grew up in a segregated community. But what they learned was the reality that there were two Americas, that there was an integrated one. There was one that treated people humanely. There was another that my father grew up in, they said, was segregated. But what we told them was, this is the truth. But what you need to think about is people as people. And that's what we talked about at the table.
Bobby, let me ask you, what policy changes do you think need to come to make real change in our country?
Well, there's a few things. First of all, it has to be against the law to kill an unarmed person, black, white, or otherwise. The police claim that they fear for their lives. They're the ones with the guns. So that has to be against the law. The chokehold has to be banned, and it has to be illegal to pay one person one salary in the same job, another person in the same job, a lesser salary. That makes no sense either. I was laughing with Ambassador Lewis earlier because both of us were fired from NMSU as good as our education was and as distinguished as our credentials were, we were both fired. We can chuckle about it now. But that's the kind of discrimination, systematic institutional discrimination that really needs to stop. Supposed to Title IX or Title VII supposedly tried to resolve those things, but it has to be enforced. And you can't have the internal organization being the police. You can't have the police policing the police, and you can't have the institution, the EEO office inside the institution deciding whether there's a grievance is justified or not. You've got to have external people that review these cases and make their decisions without the influence of being part of the internal problem that people are complaining about.
Austin, back to the protests. You mentioned you've been going, and we talked a little bit previously, and you were nice enough to talk to us about heading up to Silver City when there was a march there. And I asked you what inspired you to go to the march in Silver City. Tell me about that.
My friend Anthony Quintana, who has a restaurant out there, Q's Bar and Grill, he said that some students wanted to put together a rally, but they're a little bit afraid. They, you know, They were going to, well, one, there's a big old population of Cowboys for Trump, big group out there, and they were a little bit afraid to do a march. I was like, man, let's go. Students, don't be afraid of anything, anybody. We're not there to hurt or burn anything down, so they have no right to use any type of force against us. So that was just to inspire more outreach, more outcry around the state. The state has its own problems that we need to deal with, you know, and so I'm glad that Albuquerque and Las Cruces and Silver City and other little states sat there and made their voices be heard.
What was your interaction like with that group? Did you end up having an interaction with Cowboys for Trump?
We did. We had a little bit of an interaction. You know, they were trying to intimidate us, so we, you know, sat there and chanted in front of them, showing that there was no intimidation. A really dope thing that happened was one of the representatives from Cowboys for Trump, they walked over and said, "Look, man, I don't hate you. I don't hate you." And then the other guy says, "Well, why don't you hear why I'm upset? Because if you understood, I think you'd be upset too." So they had a talking and they shook it out. And, you know, that was a good moment to see, because it's really the unity, I feel like, is what really makes the establishment shake. Because that's how we can start getting things done, not just with people that look like me, Dr. Bobby, Ambassador Lewis, but people that you can't tell. Like, I don't know who is on their side. So that unity is what I'd like to push for. But only if they're truly trying to go forward, because you're going to lose friends. You might lose your job. The way I feel like this is going to go, it's going to go to be changing. I feel like history is going to be teaching our grandkids about today. What sparked the revolution? What sparked the change? And it's been time.
Right.
Hold that thought. Go ahead,
Delano. I just want to say one thing about Bobby Green mentioned in MSU and about being fired from NMSU. I just want to let the record know that I resigned. So I had some differences.
Yeah, me too.
Now whether those differences related to race is yet to be determined. I didn't leave because of that. I had some differences with the provost at the time. But that's part of the issue that you just don't know. And in my case, I did not think it was race, but others may have thought otherwise. But that's the kind of issue, because we just don't confront each other. We don't talk to each other. We don't listen to each other. And we base some decisions on race. But in my case, it was not the case.
Let me bring Wayne on the line. He has been holding with a question. Good afternoon, Wayne. Sorry, I think Hello. I have you up now. Are you there?
I'm here. Can you
Hi.
Hear me?
Hi, yes. Thank you. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, this is Wayne Huber. I know all of three of you. How are you all doing today? It's good hearing
you. How
you
doing, Wayne?
Hello, Wayne.
I'm good. Hi, how are you, Delano? Good seeing you.
I'm good. Good to hear your voice.
Yes, thank you. So my question is, how is the city responding to all of your concerns? I know that some of you have met with various people, for the city council, the mayor, the police chief, and the police department. What has been the response?
This might be a great question for Bobby to start with, because Bobby, if I'm not mistaken, you were part of the city council meeting where Las Cruces Police Chief Gallagher, I think, was involved, and there was a presentation about 8 Can't Wait. And what have you taken away so far from what the conversations are?
Well, I did participate in that meeting on Monday. The chief of police did not show up, but Deputy Chief Dominguez showed up, and the attorney, they lawyered up and, you know, all of that, which they mentioned that there is an ongoing litigation that they have to be cognizant of, and I understand that. But the dialogue was very useful. The chokehold has been banned. And they are looking at all of the de-escalation and all of the other initiatives that are part of 8 Can't Wait. And I agree, they cannot wait. We are scheduled to have another working session to try to resolve and come up with some police reforms. I hear there's been some questions about having an audit. I think it should be an external audit. And again, that goes back to the internal departments policing themselves. So I think we should bring in some external support. And the mayor is listening to everybody's perspective. He's in a very precarious situation because some of the people believe that, we can't get rid of the police because but we're not trying to get rid of the police. We're simply trying. We don't have being the number one state in the country with regard to police involved killings. I think that's just an atrocity, and we can't really have that continue. Tomorrow at the local NAACP meeting, we will have the mayor, who has agreed to come and speak to us, and we will also have Representative Sochi Torres Small. So again, as I mentioned before, we are working legislatively to try to make some changes. I know the National Black Caucus has put forth some recommended police reforms in their House resolution, as has the GOP. And so hopefully there will be some common denominators there that we can implement fairly quickly. And it has to be done at the legislative level.
Thank you. Obviously, defund the police has been a phrase that it seems to maybe have gotten co-opted even to take us off in a different direction. Austin, what does that phrase mean to you?
Defund the police, that phrase means to me that it's not going to just take the money away from the police. It's just, not just take all the money away. They get $25 million a year, okay? And they only spend like 1% of that in their internal affairs and in their de-escalation training. So like that Dr. Bobby Green said, audit is definitely at hand, because like $25 million a year you're spending on brand new cars, new riot gear, new SWAT vans. Get out of here. That's baloney. With defunding the police, to put in perspective, they've been defunding the education system in New Mexico for probably like 20 years. So the schools are still here. They're trash, but they're still here, you know. And in the police, they have this $25 million budget yearly to be doing the trash job they're doing. They're obviously not spending that in the right place. They need to send that money to those external companies that are going to audit them, that are going to train them, that are going to investigate them. That's how I feel like we can move around this one. They got a lot to work with.
And one of the programs that we're hearing about is CAHOOTS out of Eugene, Oregon. Delano, this is an organization made up of mental health professionals who take some of the 911 calls involving people who are having a mental health crisis. So they are the ones that respond to those instead of police officers. Do you think that is a valuable alternative for every community in America, including our own?
I certainly do. I strongly believe that mental health is an important issue that needs to get a lot more attention than it does. And definitely that's an important piece. I agree with Austin and defund, and Bobby Green says the same. It's not getting rid of police. That's sort of a misinterpretation. It's the use of the monies in that budget to help us as community, bringing community and policing together. And obviously some cases could be treated by social workers, by mental health workers, dealing with domestic violence, et cetera. These are not all criminal kinds of activities going on in the various communities. So the more we could work as a community with law enforcement, the better off we're going to be. But there has to be some understanding of people and their training as police officers. So I would think mental health definitely should be encouraged as a part of that training.
Bobby, I'd like to get your perspective on the calls for defunding. You seem to be nodding your head very much in agreement. What would you add?
Well, I'm a member of the New Mexico Law Enforcement Academy Board, and I mentioned this in the city council meeting, that this is a reactive approach. We see the cases after the complaint has been filed, after the offense has been committed by a police officer, or at least the claim that an offense has been committed. And so that's when we see the cases. But if we could do a little bit more proactive, look at who we are hiring and do some psychological evaluations and consider bringing in some community members to sit on the board and decide who gets hired as police officers and who doesn't. I think that could eliminate some of the back end issues that I spent a whole day yesterday dealing with. I also think that you don't send, for example, a SWAT team to deal with an 81-year-old man who's distraught. You send a social worker, you send a counselor, you send a mental health professional to deal with that. You don't send a SWAT team and kill the man, 81-year-old man. That's outrageous. And so having the 911 dispatch, no, if it's a call for a homeless person, you send a social worker. If it's a call for domestic violence, maybe you send a counselor, you send somebody that can talk to both parties. If it's a person who is suicidal, then you send somebody that can talk to them and find out what the issues are, rather than always sending a person with a gun, two people usually with guns, to deal with the issues. All the police respond the same way, regardless of the nature of the call. And I think that really, really needs to change. And these minor traffic infractions that turn into a death sentence, as it did in the case of Rayshard Brooks, that has to be changed. Because first of all, you don't need two police officers with guns to show up to when a man is sleeping in his car at the drive-thru. You call a tow truck, you knock on his window, you give him a ride home. There's so many other alternatives to always going to the first, the last defense is a weapon. You know, you have, that has to change.
Austin, I wanted to ask you about raising kids and teaching your kids about this struggle.
I've always been honest with them about the world, and you know, some of my kids are mixed, and I always had to tell them, I was like, look, bro, just because you have a drop of black blood in you, man, they're gonna look at you like a black man. You may be able to fool some, but you ain't gonna fool all. And not to sit there and have you afraid of the world. I don't want you to sit there and think that everybody's being racist to you. But it took me a long time to realize that him just being racist. It had nothing to do with me. You know, like, well, why don't they like me? So it's a fine line to try to teach them the reality of the world, but to also not let them be afraid of the world or to feel like we don't get to have the victim mentality. So that's another thing I didn't want my son, especially to like, well, don't blame everything because you're black, because they don't care. It may be, but they don't care. So you just got to figure out how your little black self can get what you need to get, how to move through the system, how to overcome the system. Don't let it beat you, destroy you, and just blame the racism for your defeat. Because, you know, we have a lot of great black men and women that against all odds, you know, did amazing things. So that's in us. You know, that's what I try to teach the kids. But the reality of it, you have to let them know, like, not everybody's not going to like you. And it could be because your hair is better than theirs, or your shoes are pretty, or it could be because of your skin.
Thank you, Austin. We have a caller on the line, Dr. Earl Misson, holding. Thank you for waiting. Sorry to make you wait, Dr. Misson. Thank you for joining the program today. Good afternoon.
Hi there. My concern is something related to the three-hour hearing we had with the city council. And that is, I think we need a civilian review board to review the things that come up with disorder in our police force. I know I've been here 21 years, so I know that way back we did have one, and it was done away with. And now it disturbed me to hear Ken Miyagashima describe how we have contracted with this auditing group who comes in and holds a meeting once every 6 months. And I think Ken referred to one of the meetings we dealt with 90 complaints that had been sent in by people in the community. And that, to me, does not ring very well. First of all, if you got 90 complaints stacked up during 6 months, they're kind of old. And I wonder what happened to the people who originated the complaint. So I would like to know what the panel feels about bringing back a civilian review board.
Thank you very much for that. Delano, why don't you start?
Well, as a lawyer, a non-practicing lawyer, that seems that makes a lot of sense to me, because you know, legal perspective, law enforcement perspective, community's perspective needs to be a part of all of this if we're going to move it in a positive direction. I was not familiar with the old Civilian Review Board. I've not been that close to the city issues, but it certainly sounds reasonable to me that such a review board could assist in moving things in an orderly fashion.
Bobby?
I think we really don't have a choice. We really do need the citizens to be involved. A review board would be a good start, because that way it is the citizens are stakeholders and we get to take ownership as well. I think it's important. I think that other communities who are doing that are having some good success. I believe that it will save a lot of money in litigation against the city. It will save the taxpayers a lot of money, and it will promote a better public relations experience for everybody who lives here if they know there's community involvement. That's my belief.
Austin?
I love that idea. And again, I'm going to refer back to the Cricket Kugler case of 1949. There was a grand jury that was made up of just citizens. And these citizens, regular day citizens, did not let anybody, the sheriff, the governor, the lieutenant governor, nobody intimidate them. And they found that the corruption went all the way up. And because of these citizens, the case was never found. But that first civil rights case that was in the judgment went for the plaintiff, the black man who was tortured, you know, that was because of them. So the people will be able to hold, we don't care about none of that corruption. We're not getting paid. You know what I'm saying? So I love the review board. I think it's going to keep everybody honest, you know, and until they start. And we should make the review board, that should change every so often, right? So that way people that are on that board, they don't start getting corrupt. Because that's what I feel like would start happening is those review boards will start getting money here and there. So let's have a citizen review board that changes out every so months and keep everybody's feet by the fire.
All right. Thank you very much for that. I'd like to ask you all, kind of shift direction just a little bit. There is an election in November, and we saw those images coming out of Georgia of people lined up for hours. Here we are in a pandemic. We talk about, you know, people going out to protest. When I see the images, I have to commend, you know, 90% of those protesters are wearing their masks. And doing, you know, what they can. But obviously something became more important than self-isolating amid coronavirus. And voting in November, voting throughout our primaries, we saw that there were efforts all over the country, you know, to keep people home. There's really no other way to look at it but to keep people home. Where do we stand, Delano, in access to voting?
Well, I think New Mexico is well ahead of the curve and has had success with mail-in ballots and do not consider mail-in ballots leading to fraud. So I think New Mexico has a great model here that it works, and mail-in ballots should be encouraged. Definitely an absentee ballots for the November election. I think this is another voter suppression activity that's going around the country that has to stop. People have to be educated that mail-in ballots, absentee ballots do not lead to fraudulent activities. I think there's no evidence to that. And I think that amid the coronavirus, people of my age certainly are vulnerable, and that being able to vote by mail is important. But it should be a part of our right as a citizen to have that vote by mail or by absentee. But you could see it going on partisan lines where these quote, and I try not to be partisan, even though I am many times, but you've seen that certain administrations are against these mail-in ballots. And you ask yourself why, because they think that maybe it isn't good for their political party. But take party out of it. It's good constitutional sense that it should be a right to have that mail-in ballot.
And Dr. Green, what would you add to making voting fair for everyone in America?
Well, it wasn't only Georgia, but if you looked at Wisconsin about a month ago, they had to wait in line for hours in the middle of a pandemic. And the NAACP has filed litigation in the state of Texas because they're trying to prevent mail-in ballots right now. And so there is a case that has been filed, and there will be several others, I think, before the election to change the legislation again, because the voter suppression tactics that are happening are not intended for the benefit of any party. And so we cannot have a situation where people are being prevented from exercising their right to vote just so that one individual person can stay in office. We've got to be able to make sure that everybody's voices are heard. I think the Electoral College is also a problem, because if you remember, it was manipulated in the 2016 election, and that's how we got in the situation we're in right now, because Hillary
2004 won
the popular 2000. Vote by how many ever million votes. Yeah, so there has been, there's a pattern there that needs to be changed. People should be able to vote. The votes should count, regardless of, you know, color, race, creed, anything like that. You just let people vote and let the voices be heard and let the will of the people be the will of the country.
Austin, how do we get the young Black community to the polls?
Voter education and voter registration. That's got to be the main campaign, like throughout the streets. The voter education part, because I feel like a lot of the kids, they're like, yeah, voting is such a, it's, you know, it's a sham. Look how did George Bush win? He didn't win. How did Trump win when he didn't win? That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about voting locally. You know, your voice is heard on the local level. And if we can't pick the president fairly, we could pick the representatives and the senators that could keep him in check. You know, so that's kind of the type of education that they need to understand. You know, when you become a felon, if they take away the two rights, the right to vote and the right to bear arms. So those things I think are very important to defend your life with your gun against tyranny and to vote these tyrannical people out. You know, that's what they take away because that's what they want. So
thank you, Austin.
The importance of it, we can make a change.
We are already so short on time, and Josie has been holding with a question. Good afternoon, Josie. Are you with us? Did I lose Josie? I may have. All right. Oh, she hung up. Okay. So this gives us just a couple of minutes.
Sorry, Josie.
Delano, I'd like to for yes. you to be able to add anything you'd like here in the last couple of minutes.
Well, I thank you for inviting me and to sharing the platform with my good friend, Dr. Bobby Green, who I have tremendous respect for and is running the NAACP, which I thoroughly support. And with Austin Trout, who I have followed his illustrious career from Las Cruces in the boxing world and who I have a great deal of respect and admiration. So thanks for having me. But I just want to add one thing. Bobby has stressed a lot about legislation. And that's what I'm really all about. A lot in my career, I've worked on Capitol Hill. I worked for senators. I worked for a congressman. And I believe the change can be happened legislatively. And I must also get a plug in for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. I've always been a fan of the Legal Defense Fund. They're the ones who brought the case on Brown versus Board of Education in Topeka with Thurgood Marshall. So I agree with her that that's the way we can change things peaceably. That's where we can move things forward. But the key is dialogue and listening to one another and having respect for one another. So thanks for having me.
Thank you, Delano. Bobby?
Well, I am very grateful for this opportunity to share the Zoom screen with Ambassador Lewis and with no doubt Trout. I've been watching him for many years. We are fans. So, you know, you got some fans here. And I'm grateful for the young people who are out there using their energy for making their concerns known. Their voices are being heard, but we've got to make sure we channel that energy into votes at the polls in November. Mr. No Doubt Trout is correct about that. We've got, it's got to be education, and voter registration are critical, and we've got to get those kids to the polls in November. If we got to buy them whatever, a hamburger or whatever we need to get them, they like food. And so we've got to get them, we've got to get the kids to the polls in November. And I thank you so much, Casey. You know, you and I, you know how we do it. We go way back, and I very much appreciate you and KRWG. Thank you so much.
I can't wait to give you a great big hug again, Bobby, hopefully soon. And Austin, the floor is yours. It looks like.
Thank you so much, Casey, for having this and having me to be a part of it. I'm so happy to be a part of this and to be on a panel with such fine, prestigious African-American people in our community. It's an honor to be mentioned in the same breath. Juneteenth. Happy Juneteenth, everybody. And let's continue to work towards true freedom, true justice for all. And I think this is a great step coming together to talk about things that people don't want to talk about and to come up with some solutions, some ideas. I don't know what the answer is, but this is what we need to get that answer.
Thank you so much, Austin. There is a vigil tonight at 7 o'clock at the Corbett Center Student Union Outdoor Stage. It is Juneteenth. Thank you all for joining us today. NPR News is next.